Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari.
Thank you so much. You didn't have to.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tiravanachari. Yamuna Tiravanachari. Yamuna Tiravanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tiravanachari. Yamuna Tiravanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivadhari. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravanachari Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahansa Puri Vraja Gacharja Ashtotra Shatashishi Mad His Divine Grace Iskan Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Gauda Premanandi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shinyavadi Vascharade Shatarine Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, chapter 7. And yesterday, Ananda Chaitanya Prabhu did text 1 and 2, so I will do text 3. And since we're all Shrutidars, we don't use a board here. Oh, okay. Okay, so text 3, interestingly enough, has only one line. A great anomaly. Ajanabham namaitad varsham bharatam iti yata arambya vyapadishanti. Translation. Formerly this planet was known as Ajanabha Varsha, but since Maharaj Bharat's reign, it has become known as Bharata Varsha. Purport. This planet was formerly known as Ajanabha because of the reign of King Nabhi. After Bharat Maharaj ruled the planet, it became celebrated as Bharata Varsha. Text 4. Sabahuvin mahim pati pitripita mahavad uru vatsalataya sve sve karmani vartamana prajasvadharman anu vartamana Paryapalayat. Sorry if I murdered the Sanskrit. Would anyone else like to chant? I couldn't figure out the meter. Sa. That king, Maharaj Bharat, Bahuvit, being very advanced in knowledge, Mahi Patihi, the ruler of the earth, Pitri, father, Pitamaha, grandfather, Vat, exactly like, Uru Vatsalataya, with the quality of being very affectionate to the citizens, sve sve, in their own respective, karmani, duties, vartamanaha, remaining, prajaha, the citizens, sadharmam anuvartamanaha, being perfectly situated in his own occupational duty. Paryapalayat, ruled. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki. Maharaj Bharat was a very learned and experienced king on this earth. He perfectly ruled the citizens, being himself engaged in his own respective duties. Maharaj Bharat was as affectionate to the citizens as his father and grandfather had been. Keeping them engaged in their occupational duties, he ruled the earth. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is most important that the chief executive rule the citizens by keeping them fully engaged in their respective occupational duties. Some of the citizens were Brahmins, some were Kshatriyas, and some were Vaishyas, and some Shudras. It is the duty of the government to see that the citizens act according to these material divisions for their spiritual advancement. No one should remain unemployed or unoccupied in any way. One must work as a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra on the material path, and on the spiritual path, everyone should act as a Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, or Sannyasi. Although formally the government was a monarchy, all the kings were very affectionate toward the citizens, and they strictly kept them engaged in their respective duties. Therefore, society was very smoothly conducted. Om Aganati Virandasya Gyananjala Shalakaya Chakshurun Militanena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. When the British first came to India and studied the social system of India, they deemed this caste system a massive exploitative enterprise. Because look, you're pigeonholed, you're categorized and forced to operate in a certain modus operandi, according to their analysis. But there's something much deeper going on here. And the deeper thing that's going on is we are all non-physical spirit souls trapped in the material energy due to our attachments to working in certain ways. Therefore, everyone has a natural tendency to work in a certain way. That can be perverted. That can be used as a tool to exploit, but it can also be used as a tool for elevation. A knife in the hands of a surgeon saves a life. A knife in the hands of a madman takes a life. Nothing is inherently good or bad. Something is categorized as good or bad based on how it's used. And in fact, in Europe, the Europeans are deviant Kshatriyas who are driven out of India. They had a perverted caste system also. There were priests. There were chivalrous fighters, knights in armor. There were agriculturists, and there were serfs. Sudras are called serfs. Exactly the same thing. And wherever you go, this universal system is set up. Krishna even says that in Bhagavad Gita. He's the designer of the system. Maya, Shishtam, how does it go? Chaturvarnyam, Maya, Shishtam. Shishtam means created, so it's created by Krishna. He's the designer. If you buy a Ford, you don't go to Toyota to ask how to get it fixed. If you bought a Ford, you go to the Ford Motor Company and you get the manual by the creator. So Krishna is the creator and the Vedas are the manual how to navigate through the material world without getting hurt. So intelligent persons, they understand we have a tendency to work in a certain way. We cannot immediately become self-realized. That's very rare. That's the Paramahansa, someone who is already fully free from all tendencies for material engagement and is absorbed in the self. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also says that only one who is fully satisfied in the self, for him there's no duty. Others must perform duties in order to become purified. So seen in the proper light, which is called Daivi Varnashram, in the proper light, we work together to elevate ourselves. We're all in a collective team. The Brahmins, by their past tendencies of work and engagements and activities, have achieved knowledge of Brahman, spirit. They are the natural directors of society, not the exploiters, but the directors. The Kshatriyas are powerful. They like to fight. They like to control. That's very useful, highly needed. But if it's not constrained by Brahminical wisdom, it becomes dangerous. The Vaishyas also, they're naturally attracted to money and to producing things, agricultural produce and money. And Shudras are persons who, in their past lives, did not cultivate any of these higher tendencies, so what they do efficiently is to serve the other castes. And if everyone does this in a non-exploitative fashion, then we all benefit. The whole society benefits. It's like a smoothly operating system, as Prabhupada says in the purport. It's not an exploitative system. It is designed systematically and logically to elevate everyone. And the system functioned expertly in previous yugas. It decayed in Kali Yuga when the Brahmins began to misuse their power. There was a son of a great Shamika Rishi, and his name was Sringi. He was a Brahmin boy. He was only 9 years old. So one day, Maharaj Parikit was out hunting. This is the duty of the king, to hunt, keep even the forest in a peaceful condition, Prabhupada says in the Krishna book, because there are sages living in the forest. So tigers and dangerous animals are hunted. The king hones his fighting skills and simultaneously cleans up the forest to keep it in a peaceful condition. So Maharaj Parikit was out hunting. Maharaj Parikit was an exalted pure Vaishnav. He was not on the bodily platform. But for the sake of, but Krishna may arrange certain leelas. So he was apparently perturbed by thirst. So he came to the cottage, the kutir of this great Samika Rishi, this great Brahmin sage. And he didn't want much, he just wanted a glass of water and a few sweet words. But the sage was absorbed in meditation. He was not faking it, he was genuinely absorbed. He was a great jnani, a great personality, a qualified rishi and sage. So he was oblivious to the external world. He was simply sitting there meditating. So when the king came in to request a glass of water, the sage did not respond at all. Which was okay, everyone was doing their proper duties. That is his duty. That is his occupational duty, is by such purification, he's then qualified to lead society. He has a very responsible occupational role. So the king, by Krishna's arrangement, perturbed externally by hunger and thirst, became angry. So the sage was not responding at all. So the king took his bow and he found a dead snake and draped it around the neck of the meditating rishi. That's a great aparad. That's very offensive, because the duty of kings is to serve rishis. The rishis were also respectful to the king, because the king is the representative of all the devas. It was a symbiotic system. But in this case, the sage did not respond, so the king was angry, so he put the dead snake around the king. It was all Krishna's arrangement, because Maharaj Parikit was off the bodily platform. He could not be influenced by hunger or thirst. He was as good as a sage, Raja Rishi, Rajarshi. In previous ages, the kings like Maharaj Ambarish, Maharaj Yudhisthira, Maharaj Parikit, they not only were the emperor of the entire globe, but they were situated in the Brahminical platform. They were both a Brahmin and a Kshatriya combined. So they were highly qualified personalities. So when a person acts uncharacteristically, we know it's the hand of the Supreme. Being arranged so that the great Bhagavat Purana could be recited. This is the setup, how the Bhagavat Purana came to be recited. So Maharaj Parikit, after leaving, he felt very bad in his heart. Being a pure devotee, he knew this is really bad behavior. He thought, I will surely be overcome by something inauspicious very soon. So the sage was deep in meditation, and his son, Sringi, came and saw. He saw his father with a snake. Oh, a dead snake. This is offensive. And the son was actually very puffed up. He had power, but he was not morally, his moral capacity did not equal his tejas. Tejas means brute force power, to curse someone to go to hell. He had that power, but he didn't have wisdom. He was immature. He was only 9 years old. So he began speaking. He said, the kshatriyas should be like dogs, watchdogs, waiting outside the door to serve their master, the Brahmins. He began going off on an ego trip. He was so high, this is the good regime of Maharaj Parikit, that young Brahmin boys had so much knowledge and so much power, but maybe not wisdom, according to their particular adhikar and sukriti in previous situation. They may lack wisdom, but they had power and they had knowledge of Shastra. That's the proof of this Varnashram system. That's why the Varnashram system persisted for millions of years. The duration of the four yugas put together is 4.3 million years. That's a Chatur Yuga. The Satya, Treta, Dvapara, and Kali Yugas all put together are 4.3 million years. Kali Yuga is only 0.43 million, or 430,000.
So Kali Yuga is only 1/10 of the whole Chatur Yuga, and so that's, Kali Yuga is considered an anomalous condition, the age of the moron. When you have to prove the existence of the soul in God. In previous ages, that was obvious. Isn't it obvious that a universe doesn't come out of nothing? Now I have to, for the last 30 years, my services have been scientific preaching. I go to universities all over the place, all over America and Europe. Even in India, I gave lectures. Now you have to prove the soul. It's not obvious. People are so dull-headed. It's not obvious that God exists or that we're a non-physical living entity. The soul is non-material. That has to be proven by physics and chemistry. We have to undergo extreme austerities using their terminology, their clumsy and inefficient, gross material science to try to prove the eternal truths of the Vedas, which were obvious in previous yugas. So Kali Yuga is a big anomaly, and fortunately it's only 10% of the total Chatur Yuga cycle. That's the situation. But we're in Kali Yuga. Here we are. We have to do something with it. Actually, there's a verse in the 12th canon saying great sages worship the age of Kali. Because if you really know what you're doing, the price of self-realization has been drastically reduced, drastically slashed. In one short human life, 60, 70 years, you can become fully self-realized and go back to Godhead, which was not available in previous yugas. It took much longer. So that's the good side. If you really know what you're doing, if you're self-controlled and fixed in mantra, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, which is the process for this age, then you can very rapidly advance. Especially Lord Chaitanya is offering not just self-realization, not just Vaikunthi, he's offering Goloka Vrindavan. He's offering Vraj Prem. the highest pinnacle of all, way beyond mere self-realization, recognizing our non-physical nature as spirit soul, way beyond Vaikuntha, the Shanta and Dasya available in Vaikuntha. Lord Chaitanya is offering you Vraj Prem, Mother Yashoda's ecstatic love. She can bind Krishna, Vatsalya Ras. So this Kali Yuga, the facility for those in knowledge is the greatest. For fools and rascals who are not self-controlled, Kali Yuga is a disaster because you get crushed by Maya very rapidly. As also described in the 12th canon. 12th canon describes Kali Yuga. It's really heavy. It's only begun. This is just the beginning. Prabhupada said, get out now. Don't wait around. It's going to get much worse. So, this is the Daivi Varnashram system is very scientifically arranged for everyone to advance. The Brahmins protect the Kshatriyas by wisdom, and the Kshatriyas protect the Brahmin by the strength of their Kshatriya Tejas. They defend the state from enemies. And they were not cowards. They didn't sit back in a bunker and push a button and send out a missile. They were on the front lines. Even Duryodhana, who had many character defects, we might say, he was on the front when the battle of Kurukshetra came. He was up right up there fighting. The Kshatriyas, you wouldn't know Kshatriya in his right mind would be waiting at home. That'd be like it's such a degraded position. That would be a Kshatriya Bandhu, an unqualified Kshatriya. So this is the scientific system. Prabhupada is alluding to it briefly in the purport because so many previous purports. Varnashram is a major theme of Vaishnav, a Bhagavat theology. Varnashram Dharma. It's called Daivi Varnashram. Daivi means, the English word divine comes from the Sanskrit Daivi or Deva, means godly. It means aiming at service to God, reinstatement in our original position. That's the function of Daivi Varnashram. So Maharaj Prickett, as he was going home, he was saying, oh, what did I do? How could I do something like this? So he got to his palace. He thought, okay, I will be cursed. I deserve to be cursed. I will happily accept the curse. He had so much power, Prabhupada said he could have counteracted the curse because he was both a Brahmin and he was a pure devotee. Pure devotee is beyond the Varnashram. But he accepted the curse. The curse came when Sringi, he saw his father, he cried out, this is abominable. He took off the snake and he cursed. He was only 9 years old, but he cursed the king. He took his Brahmin thread and he cursed. He said, I curse this king. In 7 days, he will be killed by Takshaka, the snake bird. When the sage Samika Rishi came out of meditation, he said, my son, you have done a very abominable deed. You have given heavy punishment for a minor offense. This is degradation of the Brahminical order. You don't understand what you have done.
The king is as good as all the demigods combined. This Samikarishi isn't the first canto. Everything I'm saying is from the first canto. So Samikarishi, he began instructing his son, and the son began to feel bad. It was all Krishna's arrangement, everything. And the sage went personally to the palace of Maharaj Parikit to inform the king. He said, "My immature son has cursed you, and I pray to the Lord to be forgiven. And you can use your powers to counteract the curse. You are the, because of your good rule, the whole kingdom has gone on wonderfully. If you're gone, this is horrible. This is the age of Kali." Maharaj Parikit held off the age of Kali. That's how powerful he was. He didn't mess around. When he was out touring and he saw some Shudra beating the legs of, breaking the legs of a cow and a bull, he took out his sword. There's no need for a court or, you know, sentence. He pulled out his sword. He said, "All right, you're finished. This is adharma to the max. This is like massive violation." So the Shudra, he surrendered, and a Kshatriya will not kill a surrendered person. So the Shudra, who happened to be Kali personified, surrendered. And Maharaj Parikit said, "Get out of my kingdom. There's no place for you here." But the Shudra said, "This is my age. My age is coming up. I'm ordained. All right, you get four places. Wherever gold is being hoarded, wherever illicit sex." He listed four things. I forget all the details. In other words, all the things that we vow not to do, if persons who indulge in those sinful activities, that's the place where the age of Kali is very prominent. So Kali personified, he realized that there were no such places available. See, Maharaj Parikit was very tricky. He made a clause, like a legalistic, you can do your thing wherever these four sinful activities are going, but there were no such sinful places because Maharaj Parikit was so qualified. His government was so expert. So the age of Kali had to wait for Maharaj Parikit to be removed from the scene, which the method for this was the deviation, the brahminical false ego was manifested in this Sringi. False ego is the most abominable thing. The Brahmins should view themselves as the servants of the other orders of society, as the Kshatriya. Everyone should view himself as the servant of others. You may, by your past Sukriti, you have a brahminical body, you have mode of goodness body, so you have more clear thinking. The Brahmins are highly intelligent. They were so intelligent, they had a photographic memory. Everyone is very proud nowadays, big hard disk. That's because your brain is gone. You need a hard disk because you destroyed your brain by illicit activities. So they don't even need, in previous ages, not to speak of hard disks, which are a big hassle. Then you have to have a computer and you have to smelt iron ore and you have to send your tankers 10,000 miles away to beat up the Arabs and steal their oil. See, to have a computer and electricity, you have so many, the stupid people don't understand the price you have to pay for these things. Entanglement and exploitation of your neighbors, beat up your neighbors and steal their oil. That's what to make a computer, that's what all the stuff goes into it. You need silicon, you need metals, you need energy, electric energy, burning oil. So the people in previous ages were more intelligent. The fools nowadays think that they're superior. This is actually inferior because you have to work hard like an ass. To maintain all this, people get up, they wake up at 6 o'clock, and they have to go to work, and they work hard like an ass all day and come back by 6 or 7. They have to spend at least 12 hours a day. Whereas in Vedic culture, even the Vaishyas worked only a few hours a day. So you see the price tag for all this garbage. The people were much happier in previous ages. They had lavish resources. They had gold and they had all kinds of rubies and emeralds because material nature reciprocated with their piety. Nowadays, because people are utterly impious, material nature withholds. So there are droughts or else there's floods. Because the demons are misusing facilities of nature, Mother Nature is punishing severely, and it's just beginning. It's going to get much heavier. So this is the proper light in which to see these things. If you meet on Sankirtan someone who says the caste system is exploitative, explain all these things. This is logical. This is scientific. It is very, it's rational. Daivi Varnashram Dharma. So Maharaj Parikit, he thought, okay, I have been cursed. He thanked Samikarishi. He was, and actually, of course, he apologized. He bowed down before the sage. The sage said, there's no problem. It's minor. The sage was so qualified. He has such good quality. He didn't take the offense seriously. Well, the sage was concerned about the degradation of humanity that would result when the pious Maharaj Parikit was removed. The sage was not concerned with, see how fallen the modern politicians and modern people, they're interested in their own personal honor above all else. This great sage, Samakarishi, he was concerned with the humanity's elevation or degradation. That was touching to his heart. That was prominent in his psychology, not his personal honor or dishonor. A great soul is not concerned with his dishonor. Trinadipi sanichena turoriva sahisana amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. This is very important for sadhakas. This shikshastika is actually a very systematic exposition of how to elevate your consciousness. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Supreme Personality of Godhead, left only 8 verses. Those 8 verses are packed with very important instructions. The first verse identifies the Yuga Dharma, the chanting of the Holy Name, the most powerful process, the optimum procedure for self-realization in Kali Yuga, the chanting of the Holy Name. So that first 2 verses identify the Holy Name. And then the end of the second verse, Dur Daivam Idrishi Ihajini Na Anuragaha. I don't have any taste. The problem is I don't have taste for the Yuga Dharma. What do I do? I'm so fallen, I don't feel like chanting. What is to be done? So the third verse addresses the cure to the no taste problem. Biggest problem in our life is we have no taste for the Holy Name or the reading of the Shastra or the other activities. That's the biggest problem for the denizens of Kali Yuga. What to do? So the Lord, being all merciful, he says in the third verse, here are the characteristics you can develop that will give you the taste. And not just a little taste, so much taste that you can chant Sada, that means always. Kirtaniya Sada Hari. So when you have big taste, you always want to chant. Rupa Goswami, he's saying there's so much taste. I do not know, I can't calculate how much taste. How much nectar is produced by the 2 syllables Krish and Na. When we chant the holy names, we desire millions of ears. What is this 2 ears? That's useless, 2 ears. What am I going to do with 2 ears? It's an ocean of nectar. This is what Rupa Goswami is saying. The holy name is like an ocean of nectar. So when we chant, we desire millions of tongues. Sorry, first the tongue. We desire millions of tongues with which to chant. Then we desire millions of ears with which to hear. And when the holy name dances in the courtyard of the heart, it renders the senses inert. The senses are no longer seeking their objects because of the taste. When the holy name dances in the courtyard of the heart, it renders the senses inert and one feels ecstatic love of Krishna. This is the real holy name. This is Shuddha Nam. Nam Aparad is a big drudgery. Nam Abbas, that's what hopefully we're trying to clean up, the anartas, the Aparad. So Nam Abbas is the Abbas means reflection of the holy name. So Nam Abbas, you're getting some taste because you're trying to give free from the Aparad. You're not actively energizing these Aparadic tendencies that are lingering in the courtyard of the heart. Nam Abbas is very potent. Nam Abbas purifies you very rapidly, so we should try to be, we should know what the offenses are and we should try to give them up. So Shikshastika is teaching us, so that third verse is telling us one should develop, one should chant the Holy Name in a humble state of mind. Why be humble? Because we're fallen. There's every reason to be humble. We are really fallen. We are addicted. Our mind is addicted to unbridled sense gratification. If you're a neophyte and just close your eyes, what does the mind think is naturally goes towards sense gratification? And the sense gratification is the cause of our suffering, but you can't give it up. It's like an animal beating its head against the wall and getting bloody and can't give it up because so attached. So we should be humble. We're really, really in a conditioned soul is in a really bad position. He's addicted to all the things that make him suffer. So the fourth verse then quantifies things that should be given up. Tendencies that will interfere with our advancement. Na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim. All the attachments which are to be given up. And so the third and fourth verses actually describe what psychology we should cultivate in order to be able to chant the holy name with taste. And then the last verses go on to describe the higher realms of bhakti, the more elevated strata of devotion. So one has to qualify oneself with a systematic process of elevation. That's the whole point of this Varnashram system, is to purify ourselves. The goal is purification. We should always keep this in mind. We are impure. We are attached to the material existence. And we want to get purified. So we have to happily embrace the program of purification as given by the master physician, The pure devotees are great doctors. They've analyzed the disease and they've given the cure. Lord Chaitanya and his disciplic succession are giving the cure in great detail. And another point Prabhupada is making here about the smoothly run society, this is very evident if you read Mahabharata and Ramayana. It's so evident how there were no homeless bums on the street begging, hassling tourists for money and laying around getting intoxicated and, you know, and making lewd jokes about girls that walk by. You're not going to find that kind of junk, that low class stuff going on, because they see nowadays people have no knowledge of how a society should be engaged. Prabhupada said there was no unemployment, and that's really true. If you read Ramayana, everything was smooth. It was so, and it was non-exploitative. The citizens loved Maharaj Dasarath. When he would walk out on the street, they would come to offer obeisances and embrace him and glorify him. It was like a family mood. The king created actually a whole family mood. He was concerned with the citizens. He would go out and he would talk to the citizens. He would invite them in to his palace. Anyone who has a grievance, come and see me. You could come see the king. You can't go and see the President of the United States if you have a grievance. The king was so responsible in the end of Krishna book, the last pastime of Krishna book, that if it was even raining at the wrong time, that means the king was doing something wrong. If rain was occurring the day, it's supposed to rain at night. If the temperature is too hot or too cold, the citizens would blame the king. The king was so expert in understanding the subtle laws of karma that if something was wrong, the king was blamed. It's in Krishna book, the last pastime. A Brahmin's wife gave birth to his son. And the son died upon birth. The Brahmin took the son he went right to the palace, to Maharaj Ugrasena, who was living in Dvarka, Krishna's city, no less. He went right to the king and said, he accused the king, Maharaj Ugrasena is unqualified. And he was heavy. He began insulting, right? Krishna was there, Aniruddha, Pradyumna. Krishna's son is Pradyumna and his grandson is Aniruddha, the son of Pradyumna. He began accusing the Kshatriyas, saying, there's no one can protect my son. How can this happen? It's something wrong in the kingdom. The son is not supposed to die before the father. And it happened 10 times, 9 times in a row. His wife gave birth to a son. The son died. He went to the palace. He's saying, what is this guy? You guys are, this is adharmic. He was heavily. And Arjuna was there. So he said, okay, I will do whatever it takes. I'm coming with my Gandiva bow. I'm not Aniruddha or Pradyumna, but I've satisfied Lord Shiva in battle. I've received astras from the devas. I will protect your sons. And if I can't, I'll hurl myself into a blazing fire. So the Brahmin boy said, I'm sorry. So the Brahmin said, how will you succeed where Aniruddha, Pradyumna, and Lord Krishna himself have failed? But anyway, all right, give it a try if you think you can do something. So he went there with his Gandiva bow and he meditated on Lord Shiva, the weapon he had received from Shiva. When the son was born again, the Brahmin's son was born dead, and the son disappeared magically, and then Arjuna's bow and arrows also were taken away. And so Arjuna, he equipped himself with mystic, he had all kinds of mystic powers. He had done many austerities described in Mahabharata. So he went to all different planets of the universe to try to track down the sons, and he went to Yamaloka, so many other lokas, and couldn't find them. So when he was about to hurl himself into a fire, then Krishna, who was his friend, he said, stop, I'll rectify the situation. Because Krishna knew it was actually Mahavishnu, his expansion, who's actually arranged the whole thing. Again, when something uncharacteristic occurs, because Maharaj Ugrasena was a qualified king, when something uncharacteristic happens, an intelligent person sees the hand of the Lord. So this gives us an idea. If you read Srimad Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, and Ramayana, the classical shastras of India, you'll see how well organized the society was, and people loved the kings. They didn't have to ride in a bulletproof car. In 1974, when Prabhupada was picked up at the airport, the devotee said, Prabhupada, we have Richard Nixon's limousine. After Nixon was thrown out, they had the limousine that was once Richard Nixon, a big, beautiful Lincoln Continental. And it was bulletproof, bulletproof glass. And Prabhupada said, bullet is expected. The devotees wanted to get the best thing they could, you know, the most opulent thing for Prabhupada. And,
And then Prabhupada began to explain, because bullet is expected because they're demons, they're exploiters. The so-called heads of state now don't give a damn about whether people live and die. Just pay your taxes and get lost. whereas Maharaj Dasarath, he would talk to the citizens. Please tell me, is something wrong? Are you happy? Is everyone satisfied? They loved him dearly. When he couldn't have a son, everyone in the kingdom took it as their problem. Everyone collectively considered this a great problem. So they all went to the rishis. Vasishtha Muni was the family priest of Maharaj Dasarath. So the great king humbled himself. He was the emperor of the whole world, but he was humble. He went before the sage Vasishtha and he bowed down. O sage, O great Lord, save us. A kingdom with no heir. If I cannot have a son, then we're ruined. Who will carry on the kingdom? Well, the dacoits will take advantage. Just like when Maharaj Anga's son was Vena. So Vena was a nightmare. Even when Vena was a child, he would kill his friends while playing with them. That you've already read. That was in the fourth canto. So this Vena was really a nightmare. So Maharaj Anga thought, well, better any son. He didn't have a son, so he got a son. Better something than nothing. And a bad son is good because I can renounce him more easily. He was thinking, this pious King Anga. But this Vena, he was too much. So one night, Maharaj Anga, in the middle of the night, he said, all right, I'm getting out of here. I'm out of here. He just walked out of he went off to the forest to do austerities. And Vena, he took over. He was a nightmare. He called the Brahmins. He said, you Brahmins are like prostitutes. Why are you worshiping the Supreme Lord Vishnu? You should worship me. Up until that time, the Brahmins had tried to tolerate this Vena. And at that point, when he declared himself greater than Vishnu, they said, all right, he's finished. By mantra, they killed him on the spot. They had so much power. This is why did the system last for so long for 90% of the Chatur Yuga, because people daily saw reinforcement. The common people saw Brahmins doing magical things. The Brahmins could light fire by mantra. They had so much tejas. But they were humble. They were qualified. They were not puffed up. They didn't mind that the king insulted them. I mean, that's bad. But that he insulted Vishnu, declared himself to be superior to Vishnu, that's unacceptable. He has to go. So just by their tejas, they killed him on the spot. Oh, he was very powerful. This Maharaj Vena, he was very, very powerful. But they killed him instantly. See, the Brahminical Tejas is always superior to Kshatriyas. So the Kshatriyas, they were very respectful, or else they got punished severely. They didn't step out of line, because they understood the Brahmins are superior. They have wisdom. I may be powerful as a Kshatriya, but I don't have wisdom. I'm carried away by passion. But the Brahmins, a qualified Brahmin is not carried away. He's equibalanced. The Sattva-guna is the motive. He's very internally balanced. He's not swayed by happiness and distress. All the good qualities listed in Bhagavad Gita. He's not moved by happiness or distress. He's not attached to sense gratification. He takes a voluntary vow of poverty. The great Chanakya Pandit, the court Brahmin advisor of Maharaj Chandragupta, he voluntarily lived in a small kutir. The king said, come into my palace. I'll give you a whole section of my palace. Maharaj Chandra, this Brahmin, Chanakya Pandit, he said, no, Brahmin must not live like that. He must live simply. So he lived in a kutir outside the palace. This is a real Brahmin, and they had real powers. That's why people respected. That's why the common men respected the Varnashram system, because the Brahmins had enough power to light fire by mantra and kill deviant kings, make them drop dead on the spot. So they respected, and the Brahmins didn't misuse that power. So the citizens not only had faith because they saw power, but they had faith because of the good qualities of the Brahmins. So that's why this Varnashram system, it lasts through 90% of the Chatur Yugas, and only in Kali Yuga, and only because the Brahmins themselves initiated the degradation by becoming falsely proud. When Maharaj Dasarath, he offered all obeisances to Vasishtha, and Vasishtha prescribed the yajna to cure the situation, because Maharaj Dasarath couldn't have a son due to his past deeds. So Maharaj Vasishtha proclaimed a specific yajna, and they carried out the yajna, and then some sweet rice was produced magically. It appeared out of the yajna, and Maharaj Dasarath gave it to his queens, his three queens, and they had sons. They had four sons, the most qualified personalities you could imagine, Ram, Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna. The kingdom was jubilant. Everyone was in ecstasy. Then one day Vishvamitra Muni came to the palace. And Maharaj Dasarath worshipped him just to see how the Kshatriyas would worship the Brahmins. He put Vishvamitra Muni up on a throne and worshipped him and said, "I am your servant. Whatever you desire, I shall perform." So Vishvamitra Muni said, "I want your son to fight against the Rakshasas." And Maharaj Dasarath said, "But my son is not even trained. I will go. He's only 16, this Ram. Of course, no one doubts his heroism. He's obviously a great personality, but he's not yet trained in the celestial weapons required to repel inimical foes of the stature of Rakshasas." So Maharaj Dasarath, he was begging. He fell at the feet of the sage and was crying and begging, "I'll go with my whole army as long as I breathe. As long as there's breath in my body, I will defend your yajna," because the Rakshasas were disturbing his yajnas. That's what Brahmins would do. They would do yajnas, sacrifices. So the Maharaj Dasarath, he knew he had to, because it was his honor. He had given his word, but he was in great anxiety. So Vashishta Muni, he whispered in the king's ear, "Your son is the Supreme Lord Vishnu himself." So then the king was pacified. He said, "Okay, Ram can go." And Lakshman was inseparable, so Lakshman had to go along. They both went. And they acted as servants, even though Ram was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he took birth in the Kshatriya family. He acted like the menial servant of Vishvamitra. Every morning he would come and bow down before the sage and say, "What work can I do for you? What pleasing work can I do for you today, O holy sage? Just name it and it is done." So Vishvamitra, he actually gave him the celestial weapons. Vishvamitra actually knew that he was Lord Vishnu, but he had to play out the part. This was all Vishnu's arrangement. So although only a boy, Ram was so powerful when he went to protect the yajna, great powerful rakshasas like Subahu and Maricha. They appeared and in horrible demonic forms. They threw down blood and pus and stool and urine to defile the sacrifice. And Ram was so expert by his arrows, he warded off all the demons and killed everyone but Maricha, who he hurled 800 miles into the ocean, because later on Maricha was required for the Leelas. He would take the form of the golden deer. Everything is orchestrated. The nice thing when you read the Shastras, you see how everything is orchestrated by the Supreme. So the point I'm making, and Prabhupada is making, is that it was a smoothly run society. There was no homeless bums begging, hassling tourists, you know, making lewd jokes about passing by women. Nowadays you see all low-class people hanging out. The downtown city nowadays is a nightmare. In downtown Ayodhya was the perfection of city planning. It looked like a garden. It had beautiful roads and gardens and palaces and everything. There was pukka. Everything was perfect. Dwarka also was, all the cities in those days were like that. So this is the advantages. Why should one take part in the Daivivarnashram system? Because it solves all your material problems and it gradually elevates you spiritually to make a final solution to all material situations. So thank you very, very much. Are there any corrections from the senior Vaishnavs or questions?
Thank you for your wonderful class. This is a simple question. What is the relationship? I can think of one, but if you would please expound. What is the relationship between Varnashram and ISKCON that Srila Prabhupada envisioned from your knowledge?
There's a very interesting chapter in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's Madhyada chapter 8, which is a long conversation between Ram Ananda Roy and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, beginning with Varnashram Dharma and going all the way up through various stages that are more elevated. And there, Prabhupada makes it clear that Varnashram Dharma is for persons who still identify with their physical body and still are attached to material existence. And that's most of us, practically all of us. So if you don't identify with your physical body and you have no desire for sense gratification, then you're beyond Varnashram. Otherwise, one should act within Varnashram. But the problem is, everything's all screwed up in the age of Kali. No one knows what they are. Actually, everyone knows what they are. Kalo Shudra Sambhava. Everyone is a Shudra or less. You're lucky if you're a Shudra. That's the highest qualified person. Mostly you're a Chandal. Actually, Chandals were dog eaters. We're cow eaters. It's even lower. There's not even a word for it. The Western mentality is even lower than the Chandal. A dog eater would be a very elevated gentleman. He doesn't touch the cow. The cow is giving... Everyone knows, you know, how sinful it is to kill the cow. So Prabhupada came. He came to this country and said, all right, what are we dealing with? 10th class man, even lower. So he said, in the age of Kali, you chant Hare Krishna and you get purified. So therefore, Prabhupada did not try to institute Varnashram, although that is valuable because the people are so fallen they can't even fit into the Varnashram system unless purified by Bhakti Yoga. So in Kali Yuga, the system is, one should fully engage in Bhakti Yoga because one is too low. One is so unqualified, he's even unqualified for Varnashram Dharma. And after chanting at becoming purified, following the regular principles of chanting, then one naturally observes tendencies of work within himself. Prabhupada encouraged the brahminical tendencies, but if you have other tendencies, that's fine. If you want to work hard for Krishna as a Vaishya or a Kshatriya, that's needed. Kshatriyas are needed for organizational work. Vaishyas are needed for collecting Lakshmi, fundraising, we call it. That's required. And if you don't have any particular talents, but you just like to render service, that's glorious. That then you fit in nicely. And if you have brahminical tendencies, that's much needed for preaching. But those tendencies will naturally come out as we get purified. Purification is what is desperately required. That's the name of the game. Purification. So chanting Hare Krishna is very potent. It purifies you very rapidly. Then you feel like serving Krishna in a certain way. Prabhupada used the term dovetailing. Then you dovetail your friend. You naturally fit in. The nice thing about Varnashram, it's not actually forced. That's the misconception. The Westerner's misconception. It's actually, when done properly, it's you naturally gravitate towards a certain kind of work. And then you like to do that. You fit in. And you feel happy. And as you're chanting, you get purified. You elevate yourself gradually. And when you join ISKCON, you may feel like working in a certain way. But after 30 or 40 years of chanting, you, and following the regular principles and doing service for the mission of the spiritual master, you get so purified that you naturally develop higher abilities, brahminical qualities. So you can't lose. The basic nice thing about Lord Chaitanya's program is you cannot lose. You actually cannot lose. You just have to follow. You simply have to have enough faith in the pure devotees, Prabhupada, to follow their instructions. And you get that faith by trying the instruction, and then you feel so wonderful. You feel relieved from lust and greed, which everyone is conquered by. Without devotional service, everyone is a tool in the hands of Maya. So when you start to feel free from lust and greed, and you feel happiness chanting in front of the deities, and you start to feel how beautiful this bhakti yoga, even the beginning stage, just being free from the attacks of lust is such a beautiful, your heart becomes so peaceful and happy. Then that's the proof. Your faith in the process is reinforced by the direct perception, pratyaksha. In the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, this path is so nice, you can directly perceive the results. Pratyaksha. You can directly perceive the effects of bhakti. Even the very beginning stage, you just have to be sincere enough to follow Prabhupada's instructions. Is that okay? Yes.
If you don't mind, thank you so much. An observation for myself, and I'm sure for others. Even after not such a long time of practice in Krishna consciousness, you learn a lot of things about yourself. Maybe not the specifics of like what your best propensity is, but you learn a lot about your specific faults and tendencies and things that you have. You could say anartas or what have you. And it seems like it's helpful to do something with those sometimes also to help us go to a further stage besides just the angas of bhakti yoga. It's my experience. Like a simple thing I'll say. Like utilizing Ayurveda to be able to deal with things in the body that we perceive that, you know, in the Western, just regular society, we don't even see them as problems. You know, it's just like, or we might, but we have just like, you know, take a aspirin or something and move on. You know, and it's like, mean, it's just some stupid thing so I can keep grinding my head into the ground, you know. So it seems like the whole Vedic culture, actually, we can't use it until we actually want to be devotees and you know, to really make advancement with it. But it seems like it has a lot of importance for those who actually are serious about devotional service.
Yes, we can. Everything can be engaged except sinful activities like meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, and intoxication. Aside from the sinful, grossly sinful activities, we can engage everything else in Krishna's service. In the first canon of chapter 5, there's a purport. Prabhupada says chemistry, physics, economics. He lists a whole bunch of stuff. Whatever talents you have acquired from your previous existence before you joined ISKCON, use those things, dovetail them. Aside from grossly sinful things, everything has value. Even physics has value. You can prove that God exists. You can prove that the Big Bang theory doesn't work. That's quantum mechanics. There's so many, whatever you're attracted to that's not grossly sinful, you can use that in Krishna's service. Because all those things are ultimately coming from Krishna. Physics, actually Vedic physics is third canon, chapter 26. Lord Kapila's description of the fundamental principles of material nature. That's chapter 26. It's entitled Fundamental Principles of Material Nature. So that's like physics. If you read that, it's a very intense chapter, actually. Chapter 26 of third canon, Lord Kapila. Very analytical. Sankhya means analysis of the material energy with the goal of transcending the material energy. So physics is a perverted reflection, analysis of the material energy with the goal of lording it over it. So it's perverted. Of course, the Western crude, the barbaric Western mentality is to exploit and control. The Vedic analysis of material energy is to transcend the material energy, to understand and transcend. Their goal is to understand and exploit. So therefore everything, chemistry and physics, can be dovetailed. They're dovetailable. Or economics, or Vedic, just what we were talking about today, this is a Vedic social system. Very, very relevant. Actually, we can outcompete. Prabhupada said the one good thing about democracy, and Prabhupada always pronounced it demon crazy. The demon crazy system has one advantage. If by our book distribution most people become devotees, or a sizable percentage, we can vote in a Krishna conscious regime. We can actually vote in. Of course, the demons are not going to give up so easy. First, they laugh at you, because now we're so insignificant, they laugh at you. If we actually become big, they're going to try to stop us because we're a major threat. Before the Soviet Union fell, the Soviet KGB, they listed three things as major threats. Rock and roll, Western clothes and Western music, and the Hare Krishna movement. We were spreading like wildfire underground. There's a great story, Shyam Sundar Prabhu, he was Prabhupada's secretary, in June of 1971 when Prabhupada went to Russia. Prabhupada went one time to Russia, to Moscow. And Shyam Sundar was his secretary. Shyam Sundar told a great story. He told me how they smuggled the first Bhagavad Gita in. It was due to Malati. Malati was the wife of Shyam Sundar. She gets the credit. Malati stuck in, it was an English Bhagavad Gita, it was one of the first ones that came out. Shyam Sundar had his personal copy of Bhagavad Gita. So when you went through, you know, security in those, I mean, they took everything apart, every little thing, tore open, like any pocket in your suitcase, everything was torn apart. So of course they found the Bhagavad Gita. What is this? So the commissar, he looked at it, and Malati had put a picture of Lord Jagannath in. So when the commissar opened it up, a picture of Jagannath fell out, and the commissar says, oh, this is baby stories, it's okay, he can take this in. Because Lord Jagannath looked like toys to them. So let's just see how Malati Devi and Super Soul tricked and cheated. That's how the first Bhagavad Gita got in. So they had it. Prabhupada the Russian security was watching. Prabhupada couldn't walk freely. Shyam Sundar was arrested, you know, as a deviant on the streets. This is all in Lilamrita. So Prabhupada had very limited sphere, and he was supposed to see one professor, Kotovsky, and Kotovsky turned out to be an atheist and a fool. Didn't even realize we're not this body. He was a fool, and Prabhupada was limited and couldn't do anything. But what happened is, Shyam Sundar met one young Russian, Anatoly. The young Russian came and Prabhupada trained him up, and Shyam Sundar gave him that Bhagavad Gita, and they hand copied it because even typewriters were under control in those days. There were no computers in the 70s, no personal computers. They could have typed it, but everything, even a tooth, every toothbrush, every time you change your underwear, you have to fill out three forms in communist Russia. So everything was under such tight control, they had to hand copy. So they hand copied this English Bhagavad Gita. They were learning English. All the young people, the Russians, wanted to learn English. They hand copied, then they translated also, and it spread entirely underground. Major threat. The KGB identified the Hare Krishna movement as a major threat because our books are completely against their rascal, exploitative, atheistic view. Prabhupada would sometimes present it in terms of, like he would call it, spiritual communism, where Krishna is in the center. But of course, they had an atheistic view, and they were not open to our version of the theistic communistic system. So basically, they considered the Hare Krishna movement a great threat, and it was a great threat. But it was internal subversion. So after 20 years, by 1991, it was finished. So it is potent. This process is actually very powerful. This Hare Krishna process is very powerful. We just have to do it, surrender to Prabhupada's instructions.
That Back to Godhead 1989, the red copy, that shows a lot of the persecutions of what the Russian devotees went through. It's really intense.
They were great heroes. There's a book called Salted Bread. And actually, Ananda Chaitanya Proof.
We have that, I think. I think we have that in the gift store. We used to. Salted Bread.
And actually, I knew Ananda Chaitanya Proof from 20 years ago. I visited Russia after communism fell. And so I knew these devotees. They were great heroes that you have to really be, to risk your life. They risked their lives. Some devotees actually died in these concentration camps. And of course, they go back to Godhead to sacrifice their life for Lord Chaitanya's mission. That's a great hero. That's an advanced Vaishnav. To eagerly embrace, to take on austerities for Krishna's pleasure, and there's no greater austerity than trying to preach Krishna consciousness with KGB, you know, security guards going to arrest you at every second. To do that level of austerity, that's full surrender to Krishna's desire. Then that you go back to Godhead. That those are great souls. They're very advanced Vaishnavas. We should offer all obeisances to them and pray that we develop that kind of desire to please Krishna, because the ultimate goal of bhakti yoga is to surrender to Krishna's desire. So we're not really yet, maybe not yet up to that standard. But that's the goal. We should work in the direction of surrendering to the will of Krishna. Prabhupada's surrender was exemplary. An old man with no money after two heart attacks, he comes to New York City, has to live with David Allen, who goes crazy on LSD. Prabhupada's running down the stairs. He had nothing. He didn't know where he was going to go. He had no money, nothing. Fortunately, Mukunda Maharaj, who was Michael Grant at the time, he rented 26 Second Avenue for Prabhupada at $70 a month. No one had $70 a month. They were all hippies. Prabhupada underwent so many austerities to make this movement run. After the first initiation, they left Prabhupada to clean up. It says in Leelamrita, thank you very much, Swamiji. It was great fun, this initiation. They left. Can you imagine nowadays getting initiated, leaving your spiritual master to clean up afterwards? And Mukunda Maharaj, to his great credit, he admitted that they used to cut in front of Prabhupada. There was a line for the shower. There's only one shower up in Prabhupada's apartment, back up above the 26th Second Avenue. There's Prabhupada at his own little room up there with a shower. It was the only shower. So Prabhupada, they would cut in front of Prabhupada and take a shower before him. Just see what Prabhupada tolerated. His Mahabhagavat, Uttamadikari Shakti Vishavatar, coming from Goloka Vrindavan, he has to tolerate neophyte disciples who don't even know what's going on. This is the tolerance of a great soul. So if you study the life of Prabhupada, you'll see the highest caliber of living entity. The pure devotee has the highest, the level of surrender and sacrifice. He could have got angry. He could have cursed them. Angira Muni would have cursed them to death. All the classical, you know, rishis in Vedic culture, when someone stepped out of line, they'd curse them. Prabhupada, he tolerated. He knew later they will assist me. So he had to, in the beginning, everyone was so neophyte, they left the spiritual master clean up. That's really neophyte, but Prabhupada saw the potential. He only saw the good, the potential. And within a few years, when Prabhupada came back 10 years later, they had a skyscraper, a 12-story building on 55th Street in Manhattan, and Prabhupada was felt so obliged. He was crying and he was telling, I feel so grateful to you, my disciples, who have worked so hard. Because then the movement was flying. Devotees were fully surrendered, going out on book distribution, 8-10 hours a day, collecting so much Lakshmi. Prabhupada's sacrifice bore great fruit. The movement took off like anything. Lilamrita is wonderful. If you ever feel depressed or that it's too difficult to, I always get inspiration from reading Prabhupada Lila. And the other books, Servant of the Servant by Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and this, the Great Transcendental Adventure by Kurma is a fantastic book. It is so amazing. There are a lot of books out now about Prabhupada's life, which make us understand Prabhupada's position is inconceivably glorious. How much love and compassion he had. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.